listener production.
The creators of this podcast would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which it is recorded. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are the first storytellers of this land. We pay respect to their elders, past, present, and emerging, as well as any Indigenous people who may be listening today.
Hello and welcome to FOFOP. I'm Charlie Clawson, and it's not often on this show, this spin-off to TOFOP, this TOFOP with friends, that we get to say we have a genuine, authentic hero as our guest, but that is the case. Podcast Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it's probably, of all the shows in the TOFOP catalogue, it's probably more Willosophy, where you actually get a lot of heroes, don't you think? At least comparatively. Yeah.
I mean,
and that's not a slide on anyone who has been on FOFOP in the past. Like, we know in your life, all of you are heroes, but yeah.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, but they don't stand up to the moral or intellectual rigor of the guest of FOFOP. That's basically what you're
yeah,
saying.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. And I know some have crossed over onto both shows. So, you know, you got to really decide who's the real heroes, I suppose.
Now, for those of you wondering, why is Charlie referring to Podcast Mike as a hero? Well, you may have missed this little bit of news from last week.
A security guard has been punched and spat on as she responded to reports of attempted shoplifting. Neary Thai is a...
Yeah, just important to point out that it's not Podcast Mike who's doing the punching and spitting of the security guard.
That's not it.
Victoria Garden Shopping Centre in Richmond. Neary, a woman's been arrested.
She has been, Pete, following this very nasty incident. It was around 2 o'clock yesterday afternoon. The woman was allegedly trying to steal a number of items.
We're in a mall outside a Rebel Sport, and you can see a very irate woman harassing a security guard in a high-vis vest. So that's the kind of context for this incident. But then the important bit, I'll just skip forward, is we hear a statement from a witness. Sorry, that's just more of the...
This is more of the incident.
I just sort of had to run up behind her. I kind of grabbed her in a bear hug, pulled her to the ground. She was sort of scratching and clawing at me, biting me.
I mean, that's the statement from Podcast Mike. Mike Liberale, whose name I had to double check because I'm like, who's Mike Liberale? Oh, that's Podcast Mike, also, a.k.a. Radio Mike. Yeah. So, what happened? What happened?
Yeah, so it was one of the, like, you never expect to, like, be in a situation like this. But short story is, like, I literally just had to break up quite a intense assault from, a woman to a security guard and kind of restrain her for about half an hour till the police came. And it was the scariest thing I've ever done. And I don't think I'm a hero at all because I was genuinely really scared and part of me was like, maybe I shouldn't be doing this, but yeah.
So let's just backtrack a little bit. So the video, and people can find this online, the video shows the fight taking place outside the Rebel. So at what point do you enter this little conflict?
So yeah, so I live across the road from Vic Gardens and I was just getting coffee.
Mate, you've docked yourself for reprisals.
Yeah.
Now, vigilante reprisals. That's why Batman wears a mask.
Yeah, it's true. So I was getting coffee with my friend Jack and my girlfriend Claire, and then Claire and I were leaving, walking back to mine. And it was literally in between work, which there's a funny story about that later, but... and then we were kind of walking past the store and Claire was like, oh, what's going on there? And then the doors just open, burst out these two people engaged in this fight. Well, one woman was just attacking the other woman, yelling, and then started punching her and like spitting on her and ripped out some of her hair, which was really scary and confronting. And then basically, like, you know, you hear a lot about the bystander effect. And you're like, oh, yeah, I wonder what I'd do in that. And to be fair, like, I was just standing there watching it. Claire went to call the police and there were, like, people everywhere. We were all just watching it. And then I think my brain was like, I guess in these moments, I think people are like, oh, someone is going to come and step in and do something here and fix this. So I was in that headspace. And then I kind of looked around and was like, oh, I think that's me. And then, Claire said she just turned around and saw me running towards it. And yeah, I just grabbed her and just put her to the ground and held her. And then two other women came to help me. And, right. and I want to name them if that's okay. Their names yeah. were Meg and Rachel. So they came to help me and helped restrain her while I kind of grabbed her. And then we just waited for the police and it was just really intense.
So that's, I mean, look, I totally understand the bystander apathy. I've probably done the same thing myself, but I am also someone who, much to my wife's chagrin, I insert myself into conflicts all the
really?
Time. Because, yeah. I just like, well, I've only once or twice have ever like had to physically get involved, but like if I see like a dispute happening, I like to go over and mediate. Jen's says it's because I should have been a priest. Like I have natural priest tendencies where I like to offer counsel and stuff, but I just genuinely, I don't like conflict. I don't like seeing people. I hate fights. I hate watching fights break out. If it's two guys punching on, I tend to let it go because I'm like, well, you know, they're probably big enough to take care of themselves. But in this instance, you could see that there was one person being overpowered or intimidated by another. So that tends to be when I'm like, oh yeah, like I want to do something. But having said that, I don't think I've ever done what you did, which is actually have to physically restrain someone for, would you say, half an hour?
Look, I've been saying half an hour. I only actually caught up with Claire, my girlfriend, yesterday because we both were really busy the last few days. She was like, it was more like 10 to 15 minutes. So I'll trust hers because I was in the blur of the moment. I was like, yeah, it was like half an hour. It might have even been 2 hours. I don't really know. But yeah, it was like 15, 20 minutes. And like, it's, do you think part of it is that Catholic guilt thing? Because I know we were both raised in Catholic families where it's like, oh, I want to walk away for my safety, but it's like that Good Samaritan story just pops up in your head and won't leave.
Yeah, 100%. There is definitely like a duty of care to my fellow man kind of thing. But then there's also this sort of thing of, I just think aesthetically people screaming and shouting each other upsets me. I don't like to see it. I don't like that kind of, and I'm interested to know, like, because there would have been part of you that, because they're two women, that if I put my hands on her, then suddenly you are opening yourself up to, you know, assault, like if something goes wrong or whatever. So did you actually premeditate how you're going to restrain her? Like, did you sort of think that through or is that just instinctive?
No, it's and one thing I'd love to say as well is like, the security guard is okay, but also the woman who was doing it, I think it's important to acknowledge that like, it's clear that like she's in need of care. Like she was drug affected and the one thing I thought is I don't want to hurt this person. I just want to, she's not going to stop. Someone needs to actually restrain her because otherwise this could be much worse for everyone involved. And I did think that because I'm like, I guess as a man, like you want every fiber in your brain is telling you like you never do this to a woman, I guess. And so maybe that's part of why I was just standing there because I'm like, well, I can't grab her and pull
in
her.
In some ways, you're like, oh, a woman should intervene in this instance, right? Like there's part of you thinking like at least that way there's less gray area if it's like a third woman and it gets physical, there's not that gray area because, I mean, it sounds like things worked out as well as they could, but you know, if you had tripped over or your body weight had landed on this woman or whatever, like it could have been like serious ramifications.
Totally. And so, but I didn't, in the fight or flight of it, and it was like one of those moments where it was just, you know, animal fight or flight. I just kind of was, all I remember assessing is, and like, if, like you said, if it was a bloke, I definitely wouldn't have had the courage to do this because I'm not like, I have no training in any kind of self-defense or anything. So I didn't know what to do, but I just kind of looked at it and I was like, okay, I'm behind her. She has her back to me. I think that if I go and just grab her and pull her, I think I can control it. That's all I thought. And then in the splits and she, it didn't look like, I mean, she didn't have a weapon. She wasn't armed or anything, or at least it, she was only using her hand. So I thought, I'm coming from behind her. I think I can just get her. And so like then I, once my brain had processed that, I was just running in And yeah, I just grabbed her and then I just sort of fell, but I just pulled back and we both sort of fell to the ground. And then that's right. where it kind of ended up.
And so she's like struggling to get free, right? Like she's kicking and...
Yeah, lots of just screaming, kicking, and then clawing and scratching and biting my fingers and stuff.
Oh, my God.
Well, just like, yeah, just trying to bite or do anything. And it actually kind of got... I think at first she was just...
By the way, my three-year-old does the same thing.
She's with me. Like,
I was trying to get her to dress this morning and she was trying to bite me and kick me and scratch me and stuff.
Yeah. So it was scary. And then, like... In a blur, Meg and Rachel just ran over. Mind you, I spoke to them both later, and Rachel, one of the women who helped me, who you can actually see in that video, she's wearing pink. She told me after, I've got a terminal illness. I've only got like a few months to live, so I just thought I should do something. And I was just like, wow. Like I think those two were, if anyone's labeling me a hero, those two absolutely deserve it, because you know Meg was next to me, they were both holding a leg each, and this was a woman who was like struggling to break free and yelling. It was very scary, and Meg kept looking at me, reassuring me and saying, "You're doing really well, thank you, like we're gonna stay." And like she was really... And then for Rachel, who said I'm terminally ill, and I just can't believe that they would put themselves in that scenario, and I've been able to like text them since, and they were both... it was just... it's really fascinating when strangers' lives kind of interact in that way.
And so the 15 minutes, half an hour, depending on, you know, who you're talking to.
Yeah, 2 hours. Some people have said 2 hours. It's getting out of hand.
2 hours until the police arrived or backup security arrived?
No, like till the cops arrived. So Claire went over to talk to... Yeah, Claire went over to talk to the security guard, because the security guard was so amped up as well, and I don't blame her. She must have been so scared and threatened. She actually came over and was kind of almost yelling at this and going, "See, we got you," like that kind of thing, which was not helping. And I understand
it's not. When you start flexing.
Totally understand why she felt like that was what she wanted to do. I completely get it. But then I just looked at her and said, like quite sternly, and I wasn't trying to be angry at her, but I was just like, "Hey, you're not helping. Can you go over there?" And then like Claire went to talk to her to check that she was okay. And then she said to Claire, I'm the only security guard on today in the whole complex." So yeah. And then I was like, "Oh my God, how much longer do I have to do this?" And then finally I just saw three cops coming running out of the center who kind of took over, which was...
I mean,
it was crazy.
It's interesting, isn't it? Like the idea of like maybe the job definition needs to be have more nuance or needs to be amended. You're not exactly a security guard. You're basically like a officer. You're like a shopping center,
a
marshal or something that. Yeah, well, not even a mall cop, because like clearly this physical confrontation occurs. It would have started as a verbal confrontation and she wasn't equipped. And again, this is not blaming the security guard.
No.
You know, I went through a period where I studied like Kung Fu for about 3 years and met a lot of bouncers and security guards who are generally martial artists in other fields. They're like MMA guys now. They just love martial arts. But I remember one of them telling me that he's a security guard and the training was like 3 days or something like that, like a written test, a couple of, days of whatever. And then he had his qualification, and he was telling me a story about the first time he was bouncing at a nightclub with another guy, a more experienced doorman. And the doorman had been, the more experienced guy had been telling him how like he hoped there was no trouble tonight because he just bought this new jacket and he didn't want to rip his new jacket and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the guy I knew was like, "Oh, yeah, fair." Anyway, so later on in the night, there's some argy-bargy. These guys get kicked out and the experienced security guard goes over to kind of like, let the guys know that, they're not welcome back and blah, blah, blah. And as he's talking, my mate reminds him about his jacket. And so the experienced guy's like, "Oh, yeah." So starts to undo his jacket, and while his hands are occupied, the other guys punch him out.
Oh,
my God. And you're the security guard. There's not a lot of like forethought going through that incident.
Absolutely. And like a lot of people like have told me like that there's been a, like, you're not supposed to have, if you're a cop or a guard or whatever, you're not supposed to have your hair down if you've got long hair, because it's a point that someone can take advantage of. But I mean, all that's like, I don't think anyone is to blame for what happened. Like, it's just, I used to work at Dan Murphy's before I got into all this podcast and radio stuff, and there was thefts all the time. And to be fair, the business used to say to the staff on the floor, if someone is stealing something, just let them go. We would rather lose the stock than someone that works for us get hurt. And I always actually remember, I was much younger, but I remember always feeling really, I just hated it because it was so counterintuitive to what I thought justice was. Yeah. To just watch someone grab a box of Johnny Walker Red worth like $600, you know, 12 bottles in there, and just grab it and walk out, and we're just supposed to be like, see you later, like, and not do anything. So, you know, the staff of the store, like, they closed the store and were just basically making sure the staff were okay. And I get that that's essentially most likely what the policy is for that business. So I don't know. There's so many just different variables to it that sort of stop people from jumping in and helping, I guess.
Yeah. I think I've told you this story before, but I got held up once when I used to work in a video store.
Yeah. You told it on TOFOP, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. And I remember, like, afterwards, I was kind of like very calm in the moment, and I did let them go. Like, I sort of tried to dissuade them. I didn't actually open the cash drawer for them. They kept sort of threatening me to open the cash drawer, and I just said, no, I'm just not going to do it.
And so were they armed with like a blade or something?
A bloody syringe, though. I had a bloody syringe. Yeah.
That's so scary.
And they sort of ran at the door, and I remember thinking, like, my initial instinct was like, oh, that's an unfortunate incident. I wonder what the circumstances are that drove them to kind of get that Catholic kind of thing of, you know, like, I don't think anyone.
Hopefully,
like,
they get their reconciliation. They go to confession. Maybe it's all good.
A good confession. But then there was like, oh, no, I actually have to call the. And so I remember calling the police, and I felt so bad about that situation because the cops were clearly had some people in mind that they wanted to go harass. Like, they kept sort of, they were showing me photos, and they were like, are you sure it's not this guy? Because he, you know, there's a commission housing just around the corner here, and this guy gives us a lot of trouble. And I'm like, definitely wasn't him. Are you sure it's not this guy?
And
I'm like, yeah, man.
Hey,
like,
was this in Melbourne or was this
in Melbourne? Yeah.
Whereabouts?
In Sandringham.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
So they were basically like, yeah, it would have been this guy, wouldn't it? No, it wasn't.
Well, they had their gut feeling, and I guess they wanted to make the work easier for themselves. But then also, I remember after the fact, my boss came down because they had to like tape up the store and stuff. And it's quite funny when they did the police tape up. Like, customers were still stepping under the police tape to come return their videos. And the cops would be like, hey, crime scene. That's what the tape on the door is for. And people are like, yeah, well, I've got to get this back. I've got to, you know.
I don't want those late fees. I'm not going to fine you. Yeah, as if I'm going to get them late fees because this has been a crime scene.
But then my boss came by after, so everything went back to normal, continued my shift, and he dropped by and he's like, he was so like, oh, well, I guess, how you feeling? You know, if you want counseling, I guess I could pay for, like, what do you reckon? One session you did? One, you know, just probably one. Just he was so reluctant.
Yeah, I mean, we could do it as long as you know it would be a pain in the ass for us, but I guess we can do it.
I mean, would you be willing to pay for half of him? Half the session?
Come on, let's negotiate here, man. Like, what, you know, it was your fault, kind of.
Yeah, but it was just funny, like, that feeling after the fact of I know what you mean by the fight or flight thing, but I also think there's sometimes in high stress situations, you just get this sort of, like, it's not calm, but you get very practical. It's like, okay, there is a solution to this issue, and, you know, there is a conflict happening between these two women. So your solution is, I just need to separate those two women. That's as far as you thought about it. And
pretty
it's
much,
interesting.
Yeah.
It's only after the fact that then you start to color in the lines and be like, oh, well, this is what was going on, that was going on. But I do think that, you know, some people escalate situations, some people are bystanders, and then there's the real practical kind who are just like, this is wrong. Like, I just want to separate the. I mean, I remember when I was in high school, there was an organized fight between these two guys who had a beef with each other.
Like literally like, hey, see you behind the gym at 3 p.m.
Yeah, yeah,
like,
yeah. So really? These guys are going to fight at, you know, after school. And so like 30 of us went down to watch this fight. And I was kind of into it at the moment. I was like, oh, yeah, this is cool. Like we're going to see a fight. But one of the guys was significantly bigger than the other guy. And within 2 seconds, he had this dude on the ground and had him in a headlock and was just like, I just remember his giant fist just like pounding on this guy's eye socket. And with each pound, I could see the guy's eye closing over more and more. And I was like, oh, this is wrong. Like this is, and so I committed the ultimate kind of sin and I charged in and dragged the big guy off and was like, you know, stop. And everyone's like, what are you doing? Like we came for a fight. It's not over yet. And I was like, well, one dude is clearly, he's not coming back from that. He's got a guy who's 20 kilos heavier than him on top of him. And it was a bad situation all around. Like it shouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
No one should have been that.
I was going to say, I think that's like exactly what it kind of was, because so much of my brain was saying, your brain doesn't know how to process it because you're so not used to seeing this. So your brain is like, oh, first your brain's like, oh, this is really weird. What's going on? Oh, this is, your brain's like, this is wrong. Like what I am seeing is not right, but should I, like, what can I do here? And your brain, like I said, can I make like the weirdest pop culture reference ever? Just because, as you know, I love Harry Potter, and there's this great moment that I'll explain, and people who have seen the movie will know it. So, in the third Harry Potter movie, Harry and his godfather Sirius Black are by the lake, and all the Dementors, who are the creatures who come to suck out your soul, are going to Sirius Black to try and suck his soul out. And then Harry looks across the lake, and he sees a figure on the other side of the lake use a spell and clear all the Dementors away, right? Then later in the movie, Harry travels back in time as part of the movie, and he's standing there watching that moment, and he says to Hermione, don't worry, someone comes out and saves us because I remember seeing someone across the lake. And then he realizes, oh, it was me. I did it when I traveled back in time. So then he runs in and saves him. And that's kind of like what I thought of after, because I'm like, like I said, I was sitting there being like, someone's going to come and sort this out. And then my mind was like, oh no, it's actually me.
Yeah.
Great to relate it back to Harry Potter.
It's interesting too, that like, I think that, you know, when I was held up in the video store, I often, when I've told people that story, say like, if their approach had been different, like if they had threatened me, like if I'd walked out and they'd hit me over the head or whatever, and I probably would have responded quite differently, but there was this sort of separation from it where I felt like, well, it's not about me, so I'm not a target. Like they want money and they want to get going. So I felt safe in that. And it's probably the same thing. You weren't the target of this woman's rage. You know, she was focusing all on the security guard. So in a sense, it's like there's a bit of safety with that, which is like, I'm just going to get involved. But if she'd turned around first thing and elbowed you in the face, you know, scratched your eyes or something like that, you might have responded quite differently.
Yeah, but she couldn't see me coming. And again, that's sort of why there was the safety. Like she had her back to me. I'm curious, like what did they, when they came in to the video store, like what did they actually say? Like was it just immediate or were they sort of walking around?
They had a little
a browse? You know,
in retrospect, I realized they had a little, because it ended up being that they had knocked over like 7 or 8 stores. I think they'd come up from the Mornington Peninsula and they'd just been hitting video stores along the way, because video stores back in the day still had cash and, you know, it was quite easy to get in, get out. But it was a guy and a girl, and I remember her being like quite attractive. And when they sort of came in, they came in like a couple and they were browsing, but she had a lot of questions. And she was being quite like flirtatious and charming, but she had a lot of questions about, oh, is this film out and blah, blah, blah. And because back in the day, you would have the covers of the videos on the shelf, and then when someone picked a video, you'd have to go out the back and get the tape to put it in the cover to bring it back.
Yeah.
So she was trying to hit upon a film that I had to go out the back to get. So she finally got it. And so when I was out back, they took that time to come in behind the counter and try and get the cash register open.
And so when you came back in, they were just there.
They were behind the counter trying to open the cash register. So I imagine that when that's executed flawlessly, they get in, get the cash, and they get out of the store before the clerks even had time to get back. behind the counter.
But you were just so efficient and good at your job, and you knew where every single cassette was, that you were in and out of that storeroom in 20 seconds.
Yeah, and they were like, realize. Fuck. I'm dealing with like the best video store clerk in history. I just remember when I came back around, I didn't know what they were doing. I just thought there was – because it was so to see two people behind the counter, I just thought they were lost or can I help you or whatever. But the way that, like, that's what I mean about if I had become the target of their, so if I'd come out and the dude had like immediately smacked me in the face, hit me in the nose, kicked me in the gut, you know, just something really violent, I probably would have just fucking, because it would have taken me by surprise. I would have been caught off guard. I would have, you know, probably been a bit more complicit. But he was so meek in his kind of threat, like he's almost apologetic. You know, he sort of turned around and pulled out this bloody needle and was like sort of pointing it at me. And he just, I just didn't feel intimidated in the slightest. And I kind of knew that, well, there was a broom, like as I had to sweep up, there was a broomstick just there. And I was like, if he gets too close, I'll just grab the broomstick and like keep him at a distance or whatever. But she got very panicky very quickly. Like as soon as I said no, she started saying to him, let's get out of here. And the guy sort of tried again, you know, open the door. And I was like, no, man. I said, look, you know what?
Sorry, were they asking you to open the till because they couldn't figure out how to open
it? Yeah, that's right. There's a special, you had to special sequence, press a sequence of buttons to get the till open, I think. Or there was a hidden button or something. But, he asked me again. And then I think I said to him something along the lines of, look, I'm not going to call the cops, but you got to leave right now. Something along the lines of that. And then he apologized. He put the cap back on the syringe and said, "I'm sorry," and ran out the door.
They didn't actually get any cash. They didn't end up. No. Oh,
I was the last one. I foiled them. I think I
you called their bluff. I'm so like, maybe, you're not going to kill me.
Who's the real hero here?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Were there lots of incidents like that in a video store? Like lots of thefts and stuff? Because Dan Murphy's was theft central, and I hate to name the business. I'm sure it happens at lots of liquor retailers, but every shift we ended up becoming like private detectives looking in around the aisles and stuff to make sure people weren't stealing.
No, I mean, video stores, the return is so low apart from the cash. Like, what are you going to steal? Like a videotape? It's worth nothing on resale.
I just want to watch Shrek 2 so badly. I'm going to steal it.
I did get there. Well, we were targeted another time by a con artist, and I didn't, and I fucked up there big time. Because in Sandringham, like Sandringham is a little village, you know, a little seaside village. So all the shop owners knew each other, you know. People would often pop in to swap cash over, you know, if they needed smaller notes or whatever. So it wasn't unusual to have someone come in. People would, because we had cash, you know, people would often come in and say, hey, can we write you a check? Because I need to, you know, and we'd give them, we'd like a bank, you know, do some money lending. So I remember there was a store being renovated about four doors down, and this dude came in and he was really charming and he was like, hey, mate, you know, my name's like Bob. I've just bought the store down the road. We're going to open a homewares. I was like, oh, that's cool. And so we're just chatting and stuff. And he said, look, I've actually got some builders here right now, but I'm short of cash. Can I just write you a check for like 300 and just get some cash to pay these guys? And I was like, yeah, absolutely. So I wrote him a check, you know, so I gave him the 300 for the check. I didn't even really think anything of it. And then I got to work the next day, and this dude had waited for each new person to start their shift, and he'd come in and do the same bit.
Really?
Each time. But it was so believable because we're all aware that there was a store being renovated four doors down. So the story kind of checked out. He was so relaxed and confident and not shifty. Like there was no red flags about him at all.
And he was not, so he wasn't even involved in the renovation. Like it was, no. He had just done the math.
He just cooked up a story.
Like, wow.
Yeah.
There was one guy I remember at Dan Murphy's who came in and, you know, he walked in and he had gotten a trolley from outside and he had put a box on the trolley that was like a wrapped gift and like a big box and it said, "Happy birthday, Mum," right? And then he went down like some of the aisles and put a couple bottles of wine on the top of the trolley. And then, you know, walked around, came back and I scanned all the bottles. He walked out and I noticed the box on the bottom of the trolley and it said, "Happy birthday, Mum." And I was like, this guy, what a great guy. He's gotten his mum a big gift. He's gotten all this wine. He's obviously heading there now. What a legend. And then my boss like looked at the cameras. He's like, "Do you remember this guy?" And I'm like, "Yeah." And it's like, "Oh, it was a fake box, and he put a bunch of boxes of Johnny Walker underneath the box." And so it was just a dummy box. So it's like
it's only in retrospect that you think, why would you come into a store with a big box or with a big present for your mum? Like,
absolutely. Like, at the time, everything makes sense. Everything makes sense at the time. And you're like, oh, and you're even like, oh, it would be so rude of me to try to question him about this box or try to like lift it up. And what would I even do if I'm scanning all these stuff and then I just lift the box up and notice that he's definitely trying to steal? Do I just go, "Hey, sorry, man, are you buying those or were you trying to steal them?" Like, do you know what I mean? What would you actually say? So it just all added up at the time, and then he just sort of got away with it.
It would be one of the most annoying things. I never got – I think I was sort of assistant manager at one point, but to be the person who has to deal with that shit would just be so tiring because, A, like if you're a part of – like if you're the manager of a retail store that's a huge franchise – you're not really making any money. It's not your store. Yeah, you really give a shit. You know, you work at Priceline. Do you really give a shit that some shoplifter's walking out with some Maybelline in her jacket or whatever? Yeah. but you do. You have to stop, and then you have to go through that whole kind of light dance of, can I see what's in your bag? No. You know, blah, blah, blah. And it's just like, it would be tiring. I just don't care enough about that kind of stuff.
There was one, I think the police did this investigation because there was one bottle of Ouzo, like an Ouzo product, and we barely moved any Ouzo. And then suddenly there was this spike in what we thought were sales of this Ouzo because the shelf was always empty. So we were always getting, it would auto order more. And then we would just like put it back on the shelf and then it'd be gone like within the week. And then we realized there was just one guy who was stealing all this Ouzo. And then I think the police did this investigation where they found out there was like a Greek restaurant up the road, and it was the only restaurant sort of in the vicinity that sold it. And then they went to talk to them. They're like, "Oh, like, where are you getting this product?" And I was like, "Oh, this guy comes in and sells it to us at like cost price because he like has some deal or something." And it turned out that guy was just coming to us, stealing the Ouzo and selling it on to this Greek restaurant without them having any idea of what was going on, or at least like not asking any questions as to how he's getting it so cheap.
I mean, have you seen Emily the Criminal, that Aubrey Plaza movie?
Yes. Yeah. That fake credit card scams that they're running. Yeah. What were they doing again in that? I saw it a while ago.
So they would just produce counterfeit credit cards that had credit values up to a certain amount. And so your job would be to go in and just buy like a washing machine or whatever. And you've got like, you know, a certain amount of time before they realize that it's a fake credit card. So you get the washing machine and then they on-sell it. And then if you can prove that you can do that, they take you up to bigger cards so you can get things like cars and stuff like that. But it's a really great movie. But it also just makes you think like, how many scams there must be out there and how naive we all are. And the irony being like, you know, so I was almost held up once. I got ripped off by a con man, but I was also running my own con game.
Really?
Oh, shit. Because you had the ability in the video store to, when someone had a fine on their account, from my point of view, when I'm looking at the screen, I can hit a button which sort of pays for the fine. So I take the money and or I can delete it.
Right.
So I'd often say to someone,
as in, it just tells the computer the fine has been paid.
Or the clerk has used their discretion to delete it. So often someone would come in, and if they had like a $20 fine, I'd be like, "Hey, look, you've got a $20 fine here. But I tell you what, if you pay now, just $10, we'll take care of it now." And so they would give me the $10, and then I would just hit delete. But
and
then
you'd pocket the 10?
And I'd pocket the $10, yeah, because according to the system, it wouldn't know. The only thing that could catch you out was at the end of each night, you'd have to print off like the day's takings as like like some software. And there was an exceptions log listing. So anytime an exceptional transaction had been made, so anytime someone was deleting fines or lowering the price of something, it would come up in this log listing. So I'd have to go through and manually like change that, sort of like go deep into the program and delete the log listings. And so I did that for like a year, I reckon, where I just sort of, I mean, I was getting paid maybe $9 an hour or something like that. So I was supplementing my income.
Yeah.
But it was like, here I was, you know, the victim of a con getting held up. But I was like, it was white collar crime. What mine was maybe not as in your face as someone holding up, but I was stealing as well.
But wait. So that was another hold up. Are you saying this was another incident?
No. I'm saying that like I got held up once. There was a con artist, but
But if I'm honest about it,
everyone's a fucking criminal when given the opportunity.
Yeah, but yours wasn't like, I guess I was going to say it wasn't like systematic or threatening, but I guess it was definitely systematic. Like you were exploiting the business's like lack of accounting or whatever.
That's what I'm saying. It's a white collar crime. It's not as kind of like in your face as, you know, pulling a con or sticking a needle and holding a needle at someone. But I also felt like this misguided justification because of like they pay me such a low hourly rate. Like this feels like it's deserved, it's payback or whatever.
Yeah, it's justice. It's justice for the poor conditions I'm working under.
Yeah, exactly.
Completely get that.
Sticking it to the man.
Yeah, exactly. It's all really intense when you, I feel bad for people who work in retail and have to experience all that stuff firsthand because it was so hard on me as a uni student. I used to hate going in because I would just feel like shit. Like it was just so abject to my values, but I knew I couldn't do anything about it because one, I wasn't strong enough or brave enough to do anything to stop people stealing, but also because you risk your job and then I'd need that job to pay for stuff while I'm at uni. So, yeah.
It's weird, isn't it? Like when you get those part-time jobs in retail, you know, when you're studying or whatever, like that's, you know, they are casual jobs or casual employment are that's the most readily available employment. So it makes sense. But geez, it gave me a bad opinion of the general public. Like after that, when I started like taking part-time work, I'm like, do I have to talk to the general public? Do I have to be face-to-face? And I used to work at a cinema for a while.
Really?
And I remember there was this one day where I hadn't had an acting job in like 6 months. I was working at the cinema and then my agent had sent me this audition for a commercial where they needed someone to play like a hotshot. Mm. And I didn't even have like a suit at the time. And so I borrowed my mate's suit so I could go to this audition playing like a, you know, hotshot yuppie or whatever. And then while I was at the audition, a text came through from my boss at the cinema saying, hey, someone can't do their shift. Do you want it? And I needed the money. So I was like, yeah, absolutely. And so I went there in the suit, the expensive suit, and just whacked on like a, you know, a t-shirt, a Palace t-shirt and started working. And this dude comes out of the foyer and he's like, oh, hey, I'm really sorry. I've just been sick in your bathroom. Someone might need to go in there and clean it up. And I was like, oh, yeah, okay. You know, I'll go do that. So I grabbed the mop and bucket and I went into the toilets and I don't know what this guy had eaten or how this incident had unfolded, but there was vomit everywhere, like along the walls, on the wall of the stalls, over the urinal, in like it was almost like he must have burst in and just done like a 180 of explosive vomit, and it had hit every surface. And I was like, and the smell, and I remember being like, oh god. And so I started like, you know, mopping, and it was one of those infrared urinals. So every time you passed too close to it, it would fill up. So the urinal would fill up and the vomit would overspill from the bottom of the urinal onto the floor, onto my – and so I'm on my knees like scooping up vomit and putting it in a bucket. And I'm like – I'm sitting there and I'm like, how pathetic is it that I am in this suit that I couldn't even afford myself? I had to borrow because I was pretending to be a millionaire when in reality I'm on my hands. You're
cleaning up this, yeah.
Scooping up vomit. Like that's level I'm at.
Yeah, that's gross. I was actually going to ask you, we've kind of in a way ended up here because I realized that 2023 is my 10th year out of high school. And like for a lot of time you like – you, sorry, it's my 11th year out of high school. Well, damn, that's worse. You realize like a lot of my life, I reference back to like how far it's been since I finished school. And I guess I was curious because we kind of went to similar schools in Melbourne. And I was wondering about like what your experience was in terms of clearly being someone who wanted to pursue something creative and maybe less traditional and maybe even more so for you at the time. Like what was your experience coming out of school and wanting to pursue acting or creative roles? If that's not putting you on the spot too much.
No, I think it was not. I think, well, I had quite a broad group of friends at high school. So like I was mainly friends with the guys who like to play footy and stuff, your traditional kind of meat and potatoes kind of high school guys. They were my core group of friends. But then in the last couple of years, I started hanging out with the guys who are a bit more alternative, who are a bit more into things like music. And so I'd sort of done drama for a couple of years, but didn't really enjoy it. And then in my last year of high school had done the musical, they did Les Miserables. And I really, really enjoyed it. Was like, oh my God, this is so much fun. And I just love the experience of putting on a show and all that kind of stuff. But there was tremendous kind of shame put on guys in my year level that wanted to be actors because it was considered to be attention seeking. Like whether or not you had any talent was kind of by the by. It was more that, and it's funny because there was a slur for it, which was you're a John.
Oh, okay.
Now it's a long involved story about that, but there was a teacher at school at the time, and I won't use his last name because he was a great teacher, but his first name was John. And he didn't necessarily teach drama, but he taught other humanities. And he was a bit of a Robin Williams in the Poet Society. Like he just loved to motivate the students. So if that meant putting on a costume or, you know, doing something unusual, like, you know, taking his class, you know, we're going to do it out on the Oval today or whatever. But the knock on him was, oh, he just loves the attention. He's just an attention seeker. And so if you were an attention seeker, you were a John. And so that was kind of something that the kids who had that performing arts interest had to sort of live with, was like, stop being a John. It's like, well, fuck, man. Like, you know, I like to sing. I like to, like, you know, do all this kind of stuff. So I knew that when I got to university, if I was going to, and I hadn't decided at that point, like, you know, I just did a communications degree. I knew I wanted to get into like media somehow. I didn't know what that was going to be, but I knew that I was going to have to separate myself from my high school ties a little bit. Like, because
do you mean the people you were at?
The guys I was friends with, not all of them, but a lot of them, they were just bringing me down. Like I just noticed like it was, they were not good for my self-confidence and my self-esteem because it was that tall poppy kind of thing. And I distinctly sort of remember, like I sort of maintained friendships with a few of them, but the first job I got was in Sydney. And so that actually took me out of the Melbourne bubble entirely. And I only had one or two friends in Sydney at the time. And so I started doing this show for the ABC. And I remember I was down in Melbourne for Christmas that same year. And I went to a party with all my old high school friends. And they just ripped into me for like 2 or 3 hours. You know, about me being on this show and how shit the show was. And, you know, I just remember distinctly having this feeling of like, okay, well, I don't want to be around friends who aren't supportive of what I do. And they are clearly still classifying me in this, like in this, with this high school mentality of, well, you're just doing it to be an attention seeker, even though this is like 5 years after the fact. Like clearly I've made a concerted effort to make this like a job. But they're still classing it down as Charlie from drama class, you know, wants to be a John.
That actually kind of surprises me in a way because like I thought like you, because weren't you and Michael Chamberlain, this is what I was thinking about because I know you and Chambo went to school together and like I just would have thought that maybe you guys were both sort of all into it at school and were supported. Like, do you know what I mean?
Michael was much more into it than me. Michael always had a good sense of who he was and what he wanted to be. And I kind of really actually just followed his lead quite a bit because we were good friends, but Michael was never shy about, I like writing, I like movies, I like this stuff. And so he was always very sure, like seemed very confident in himself and very sure of himself. And, you know, even with the university course I chose it partly because that's the course Michael was going to do. And I was like, well, if Michael's choosing it, then, you know, that gives me confidence. But Michael's different in the sense that he's maintained all his friendships from high school. Like if I need to check in with anyone, Michael's the first person I go to because he's still mates with all those guys. And he never felt that kind of, I don't know for a fact, but I feel like maybe he didn't have the same kind of issues that I had whereas I felt like I need to start again. I need to,
reinvent
myself.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not rebrand. It was probably
too early for a rebrand. Didn't have a brand at that point. Yeah.
But I did sort of feel like, you know, I in some ways I regret it because I never went to my 10-year, I haven't been to any of my high school reunions. And part of me didn't want to go back to them because I sort of felt like, well, I don't want to go back there. Like I loved my time at high school. I had a lot of friends in there, but you know, like Chambo and maybe one or two others, I'm only still really good friends with. And I do regret it a little bit because from time to time I will be contacted by someone or I'll bump into an old friend and I'm like, oh geez, like did I let something slip there because my ego was so fragile? I felt like I needed some kind of separation. But then the other part of me, like I'll Facebook stalk these reunions. I'll look at the photos and I'll be like, fuck, I couldn't even name 90% of the people in that room. Like, I don't know how much we're going to have in common. It's been almost, I'll be coming up to my 30-year reunion soon.
Yeah.
And I honestly don't know what I would talk about. I haven't seen these guys in 30 years, barely had a conversation. What are we going to talk about? I don't really want to go back to talking about high school and teachers that we, you know, it seems to me that seems a bit weird, but I don't know. I mean, I think that maybe I should have gone to at least one of them, but I wasn't ready. The 10-year one, I just was too soon. And then the 20-year one, my mother was ill at the time and it was going to, they were sort of coinciding around, when the reunion was happening was when my mum was quite ill and it's just like, because a lot of people are going to ask family questions and I just wasn't in the headspace to answer any of that. And I actually had one of my mates who was the school captain reach out to me and say, hey, man, like I've noticed you have an RSVP'd. It'd be great to see you there. And I just didn't answer. And I feel a lot of regret for that I didn't actually just sort of explain to him what was going on and why I felt like I couldn't be there.
But that's also just probably, like the headspace you were in at the time. I guess as well, like did you find it? I guess you've kind of already spoken to this, but did you find that there weren't, aside from just like your school musicals and stuff, did you feel like there were avenues in which your school encouraged you to do that kind of work?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, no, definitely. It was very much a footy school and, you know, like, and things like drama and all that kind of stuff were considered sort of Mickey Mouse subjects and weren't given their due respect. But at the same time, they had incredible facilities and really good teachers and, you know, the productions they put on are, you know, almost professional standard in terms of like the money spent on the sets and the lighting and all that kind of stuff. So I don't want to make it sound like, you know, the arts were neglected. It was just, you know, in my year level at least, you felt like a bit of a pariah if you kind of, you know, actively pursued the arts.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Interesting. And aside from you and Chambo, I always find it interesting. Like, were there other people in your circles, even maybe not even including your school, but just other schools in your sort of year level that have gone on to pursue those careers?
Well, in our year, Lawrence Leung was in school with Michael and I as well. So
there you go.
Yeah. And then, I think there's a couple of other people. I can't think off the top of my head. But it was interesting sort of getting to uni because Michael, even though we were at the same university or at Deakin, Michael was doing a heap of reviews at like Melbourne Uni and
– yeah, like the law review and stuff that
– yeah, and that's how Michael – I think Michael kind of got started in comedy is he was just doing these reviews. And so I would go along – and meet some of these guys and be like, oh, okay. And that's when you sort of start finding your tribe a bit where it's like, oh, these guys are all like super smart and, you know, they're into the same, they're into comedy and writing and all this kind of stuff. There was a point where I was like, oh, maybe like I should actually go study at like a NIDA or something like that. But I always just much more preferred the getting it, just doing it kind of stuff. Like that's what Michael and Charlie and I did when we all started working at the same production companies. We just write sketches and just go out and shoot, kind of like what you do now.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, I guess I just – I always just find it interesting because I remember when I found out that you went to the school you went to and I was just like so shocked because I was like, how could this guy have gone to that school? Because it just like I just couldn't imagine, like I didn't feel necessarily in my school that I had like I was encouraged to pursue this, and I feel like if I had, I might have been 5 years ahead because I would have actually started doing what I like doing much earlier. But yeah.
I often think that too, like if it hadn't been so stigmatized at my school, would I be much more advanced? Because I think that, you know, there was this part of my reluctance to keep going with drama and stuff was I just didn't want to be called a John. <You know>? I didn't want to be seen as an attention seeker or anything like that. It's interesting. I know what you're saying. Like, I mean, we can say the school Xavier. I went to Xavier, which has a specific reputation that, you know, they're always, it feels like every year Xavier's in the paper for some horrible thing that like an old boy's done, or, you know, like it's got that super privileged kind of.
Yeah. I grew up reputation. In Q, and like every year it was like, and it's a great, I'm sure it's a great school, but it was always like muck up day, Xavier boys like parading the streets of Q. Yeah,
hijack like a jumping tram on and cars. Drove it into a McDonald's.
Yeah, exactly. So it was a lot of that.
I mean, it's a weird thing because like even though my brothers both went there, by the time, they're much older than me, by the time I went to Xavier, like my family had lost a lot of our money because my father had passed away and then Mum had invested Dad's life insurance poorly and we'd lost our life savings. And the only reason I got to go to Xavier is because I was on a scholarship. And I was kind of acutely aware while I was there that I didn't have as much money as a lot of the guys that I was going to school with. And I never really felt like, I mean, I was friends with all these guys, but I always felt different because people with money act differently. The way they interact with the world, the way they view the world, it's different, you know? And for a couple of years at least, I was like, oh, maybe this is the wrong school for me because I don't identify with a lot of these guys, their interests and their families. And it was very kind of, you know, they're all liberal voting. You know, they, at the time, I can't remember who the premier, they love Jeff Kennett, you know, that was, and like, I remember one class where a teacher literally just spent the entire class just saying why Labor was such a bad party and why the Liberals will get us out of this mess. And I remember thinking, this is a weird, like it's a weirdly sort of politically tinged lesson. And you know, like the anti-abortion thing as well. Like, so all that kind of stuff made me go like, oh, I'm not part of that. And Chambo was also like that. I think that's why, you know, we stayed such good friends, was we always sort of felt a little separate from that rah, 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 old boys network. Yeah. I mean, in some ways you buy into it because when it advantages you, but then, you know, some of those guys can't step out of it. Like I remember one guy saying to me like, well, you know, you'd go to a party, like a high school party, and the Xavier boys would get together and they would chant, they'd do the Xavier chant.
Yes. Like, yes.
They would get in a big circle and do the Xavier chant. And it's like, who fucking loves their school that much?
But I do. You know, that exact same thing would happen with my school. And I'm like, why are we singing the school song when we finished school like 4 years ago and none of us have anything to do with the school? Like, it was a good school, but like, why are we doing this? It was so weird. I kind of agree with you just quickly because like my brother and I both had scholarships as well. So we were sort of, you know, we wouldn't have gone to the school we went to if we didn't have the scholarships. And I grew up, the house I grew up in was like a unit and there was two units on the property. My nonna lived in the front unit. So I grew up like we lived with my nonna essentially. And, you know, I always felt weird about having friends come over to my house just because I was like, oh, it's just weird. Like they all live in these big houses with their parents and I live in like this unit with my nonna out the front and stuff. And like, you know, people at school knew I was Italian as well, but then I remember the first time I had a friend come over, I invited a friend over and we walked into my house and my mum, my dad, and my nonna were all in the kitchen hand-making pasta together. and they say hi to my friend, and then we go into the backyard, and my friend, who was like an Aussie guy, just looks at me and he's like, "Dude, I knew you were Italian, but I didn't think you were that Italian." It's like, what did you think? Like, he was just like so confused that my parents were in the kitchen with my nonna speaking Italian and making pasta. But it's just that like cultural difference that like I felt weird like you, because I was like, I definitely don't have as much money. Well, my family definitely doesn't have as much money as all these other families and stuff. And yeah, it's just interesting to talk about that stuff sometimes, I think.
Yeah. Well, I'm always fascinated, like, that reputation that Xavier has was there long before I went there and seems to still be around. Like, when you tell people that you went to Xavier, they're like, oh, like, you can sort of see, like, it evokes a certain kind of stereotype. But I'd be interested to know how much that has changed, like, or has the culture shifted? Because a lot of it, to me, seemed to filter down from the parents. Like, it was very much the old boy, like a lot of old boy dads were sending their sons there, and they had affinity for the school. And, you know, like one of my mates at school, I remember him saying, "When I have kids, if I have boys, they're definitely coming to Xavier." And I'm just like, why?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's a good school, but why definitely? Like,
surely you wouldn't even think about another school.
Like, surely there's lots of good schools, or maybe, you know, they should think about Steiner or something like that. But it's weird to be in that system and benefiting from that privilege, but also feel not accepted by it. Like, I don't know, I didn't have the Italian thing or any kind of obvious separator. It was just more a ideological sensibility thing, you know, like my family were fairly kind of left-leaning.
Right.
I mean, half my family were gay, you know, I didn't know, no one ever talked about any of that kind of stuff or, you know, seemed to, and my gay brother was the drama teacher at the girls' school across the road at the time. And so a lot of my mates who were doing, you know, drama with the girls' school would come back and be like, "I met your brother. Is he gay?" And at first I'd deny it. I was so kind of like scared of what, you know, they would say. And then I think it got to sort of the last year of high school. I'm like, why the fuck am I – like, who am I protecting here? Like, my brother doesn't need protecting. He's fine, you know. But it was more like I just grew tired of having to sort of fit in that box. And I think that was part of my desire when I left high school, is to reinvent myself. Was I knew that I wanted to hang around girls. Like, not necessarily just so I could have girlfriends or whatever, but literally I'd just been in the company of predominantly guys for 4 years and I was sick of it. And I remember thinking when I started uni, like, I just, oh my God, there's girls here that we can just talk to and hang out with. And like, I just really, really enjoyed that. And, you know, I'd go visit my high school mates, you know, when they're at uni. It's like, are you still carrying your high school bag to uni? Like, get yourself a fucking backpack. What are you doing? Like, cut the cord, man. Like, it's time to move on.
I think, like, at the end of year 12, we got those, like, you know, those, like, year 12 kind of varsity jacket style things with your nickname on the back. I swear I wore it once. And then I was like, well, now I've finished school. I'm not going to wear this to, like, a nightclub or to a party or something or a family gathering. So just... pretty sure it's still in my wardrobe at my mum and dad's place, just sitting there, because why would I ever wear it? Like, anyway, it's
I
just
still
so
get
crazy.
These emails from time to time. Like I have obviously ducked and weaved and they've lost, but they keep getting my email address. So like it'll go like 3 years with no contact. And then they've tracked me down again. I'm like, who's the fucking snitch who's given up? I mean, it's gotta be Chambo, right?
Like, Charlie would love to help out. This is his email.
Who's the fucking snitch who keeps putting my name onto this old Zavarian fucking mailing list? And it's always some kind of appeal for money. And it's like, well, you're coming to the wrong guy. All right.
Yeah.
I'm not paying for the new fucking gym or whatever it is.
Yeah. The new pool. Yeah. They used to open the pool at Xavier as like a public pool
weekends. That's right.
The Stevenson Center. We used to go there all the time when we were kids. It was really fun.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they built that while I was actually at, this is how old I am. They literally built that while I was at high school. Like, I remember there was the pride and joy of the school is they'd raised something like 10 million, something, a ridiculous amount of money for a high school for this one gymnasium that you could probably fit a bunch of high schools in.
Definitely. Like, and really a pool with like 3 meter diving boards and like everything a kid could want at that
pool. If you want to know like what, like the counterculture force that Chamber and I were. So they built this amazing gym, right? And then when they opened it, like it was run by these fucking fascist kind of like, you know, these PE teachers and stuff who just like, they had this really rigorous sign-in policy, and because we thought, oh, it's a gym, we'll just be able to go in and play basketball or go for a swim. No, and they were really strict. And so Chamber and I, the school magazine had been dead for a number of years because students had promised to print one version and then had printed an unapproved version, and it like had brought the school to its knees.
Yeah.
So they had banned the school magazine for like a decade. Then Chamber and I lobbied the headmaster to let us revive it, and so he did, and we wrote a scathing editorial.
Did you really?
About the gym.
So did you have to get the headmaster on side by being like, look, we just want to talk about the school. We want to talk about all the good things about the school. He's like, yeah, great. And then, bam, you just totally did a reversal.
No, we were quite honest about the fact that we needed to shine a light on some of the inequities in the school. But I don't think they were – because I remember, like, it was funny, really, because normally the school magazines are mostly jokes. But there was – I wrote the one about the gym, like about these fucking – these empowered, glorified PE teachers who are telling us that we can't come to the gym that we paid for with our own money. And then Michael did one. He had like the back page, which was the rowing carnival had been on, and Xavier had copped a lot of shit because really offensive chants had been going on and stuff. And Michael wrote this scathing rebuke to like the students who are chanting that blah, 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 yeah, grow up. And it's just like.
That's amazing. I'm surprised you didn't get into journalism after all that.
Yeah, we could have. I remember the cover of the magazine was our assistant principal. We'd taken a photo of him and we had photoshopped his head onto the baby from the Nevermind album cover. And that was our like satirical
What version of I had to airbrush Photoshop the baby's dick out there. Oh, okay,
it was a beta. It would have been a beta Photoshop, 1994.
Yeah. Wow, that's when I was born.
Yeah.
To put in perspective for how old you are. No, born, just joking. Yeah.
I was sticking it to the man.
Yeah. Good. Good to see you've always been that kind of character, man.
Rebel rouser. All right, Mike. That's been a great catch up. I'm glad okay, and I'm glad the situation resolved itself in a peaceful way, and hopefully all parties concerned can get the help that they need. Mike, what do you need to promote?
Oh, I'd love for you to check out my podcast, 20th Century Boy. You can just Google it or follow me on Insta at radio.mike. I'm doing a bunch of stuff on my big year of footy for Two Guys, One Cup as well, which has been awesome, by the way. So thanks to you and Will for giving me the shot to talk shit about footy. And I do have an update that I'm working on hopefully in the next month or so, depending on when this comes out. So, yeah, I'd love for people to listen to that as well. So, yeah.
We'll put the links to 20th Century Boy and everything else in the episode description. But that's it. That's Hope Up this week. I'm Charlie Clawson.
I'm Podcast Mike.